Dr. Wilson, if someone just met you and was not familiar with your work and asked you what you do for a living, how would you answer that question in just two or three words?
I'll answer it in one, naturalist. I'm a person who would have preferred, I think, to be born in the 19th century and spend my life exploring as a Victorian biologist and naturalist around the world. It's a word that encompasses the study of natural history in the broadest sense, and therefore whole realms of biology as well as conservation practice.
How long have you been a field biologist?
Well, if you include devoted amateur, I guess it goes back to about the age of 9. I started working on insects then, and I never quit. As I like to say, every kid has a bug period, and I just never grew out of mine, and I lucked out of being able to go on to a university and then into an academic position that allowed me to continue that work.
Are you also an environmental activist? Would you just use those words to describe yourself?
Yes, fair enough. I have been since the late 1970s when I decided that I should be doing something as a scientist about part of the world that I saw deteriorating before my eyes, namely the natural habitats of the world, and especially in the tropics where most of the species of animals and plants live.
What specifically prompted you to make the leap from being a scientist to being an activist as well?
Until the 1970s, although I was very aware of what was happening, after all, I had written the book with my late colleague Robert MacArthur at Princeton University on the effects of fragmentation of the environment and the extinction rate. The book could then became part of the basic literature of conservation biology. I assumed up to that time that conservation organizations and enlightened bureaucrats were looking after the environment. That was a foolish underestimation, or overestimation, I should say. In the late 70s, we got some of the first precise figures on the rate of deforestation, especially in the tropics. And with that in hand and the concrete knowledge of just how fast the tropical rainforest, where most of the plants and animals live, how fast it was disappearing, I realized that, in fact, the conservation movement needed scientists and not just conservation professionals as dedicated as they are.
Is there pressure within the scientific community for scientists to not take that leap into activism?
You hear that concern once in a while, but it's half-hearted. I think the analogy is that you would expect an astronomer who saw a 10-kilometer-wide meteorite on a collision course with a planet to become an activist, to do something about it, not just publish a scientific paper somewhere and hope that political leader or media person would pick it up. And I see this as the decline of biodiversity, destruction of natural habitats, as a comparable event.
When you were asked by Harvard Magazine years ago, you chose that as the most pressing issue facing humanity, the loss of biodiversity, the extinction of species that was going on right now. Why is it biodiversity and not the pollution of the environment or even a social issue that is the most pressing for humanity right now?
That's an excellent question. The reason is that pollution can be eliminated and social problems can be solved. It is a matter of a potential reversal. But that is not the case for the loss of biodiversity. The species of plants and animals around us are, on average, hundreds of thousands or more years old. The average species life, as of a species and the daughter species that evolved from it by evolution, has in the geologic past run from 1 million years roughly to 10 million years before human interference. We've increased that rate of extinction by, I think almost all experts agree, somewhere between 100 times and 1,000 times, and thus shortened the lives of species accordingly. These species cannot be replaced except by more tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of years of evolution, periods of time, I think, beyond human comprehension, so that when we lose the creation, or a big part of it, the creation being the fauna and flora of the world, we are losing something that is extremely precious to humanity and is not recoverable.
If you're just joining us, my guest on the Allegheny Front is Edward O. Wilson of Harvard University. In your autobiography, you describe a recurring anxiety dream. Could you describe that for our listeners?
Yes, every person has anxiety dreams. The dream that you referred to is the one I have had repeatedly, that I'm on an island somewhere studying the fauna and the flora. And it's come in, I have been there a long time, but I haven't done it. And I'm supposed to catch the plane. So I frantically start looking around for natural environment. And I'm unable to find any. It's all suburbs and agricultural fields. And finally, in the dream that repeats itself over and over, I see on the horizon a fringe that looks like a forest. And so I head there, running or in a car, and come up to the edge of this and discover that it's just a hedgerow and that there's an agricultural field on the other side. Actually, that's a dream that many biologists find reality when they visit different parts of the world. They look desperately for some remnant of the natural forest, for example, and can find none. In reality, recently I visited the island of Barbados, which has never been studied for ants, the group I work specially on. Would I find native ant species there? I knew Barbados was nearly completely cut over for sugarcane in the 17th century, yet I knew as well that there were certain ravines and little patches of woodland here and there where I might find native fauna and flora. I had the help of a faculty member of the University of West Indies in hunting these last remnants down. And I did find native ants, but it also was a scene that was and is emblematic of the condition of much of the world today. The natural environment shrinking down to small fragments here and there, with many of them destined to disappear altogether.
I'm sure we could spend a few minutes listing all of your accomplishments, but I'm curious to know, what do you most hope to accomplish in the future?
Well, it's something that I have two things in mind, and again, it's not what I accomplish so much as what people of like mind are trying to achieve together. The first is universal awareness of the value and the perils of facing biodiversity, the species of plants and animals of the world and the natural environments in which they live. They really are disappearing fast, and humanity needs to get itself geared together to save as much as possible while we're taking care of human needs. I believe that's spreading as a perception of the way the world really is and of a vital need. The other thing I hope to accomplish is expressed in a book I'm just bringing out at the present time called Consilience, the Unity of Knowledge, which is the basic conception of knowledge as not endlessly fragmented and attended to by highly specialized experts, but having an underlying unity of the kind we find throughout the natural sciences, but extending actually to the social sciences and humanities, an underlying humanity, unity rather, that emphasizes our common humanity, our biological nature, our biological origin, and the fact that we live on a biological planet. You can see why this naturalistic viewpoint, which I think is shared by most natural scientists, but certainly not by many social sciences or humanities scholars, is consistent with the need perceived to save the natural world as part of human, of the part of the human condition that our descendants will regard as most valuable.
Next is part two of our interview with E.O. Wilson, focusing on his most recent book, Consilience, the Unity of Knowledge. In it, Dr. Wilson states that the ongoing fragmentation and specialization of human knowledge is the wrong path for us to take. He argues for a more fundamental unity of the laws of nature, from biochemistry and physics to sociology and the humanities. This ambitious book is an attempt to do nothing less than change the course of science and alter the way humanity views the world. Here again is Chuck Starsnik speaking with E.O. Wilson.
You've written several books. including the sociobiology textbook, The Theory of Island Biogeography, which I hope you won't mind calling pure natural science books. But books like The Diversity of Life, I would say, took you into the field of ethics as well as natural science. Is that fairly accurate?
It's quite accurate because I saw that, the natural world, seen through the eyes of a natural scientist, is a superb arena for exercise of literary expression. And then, too, I saw that literary expression tying the entire conception of the natural world, again, you know, as seen objectively through science, to humanities is a very valuable, maybe it's an essential way to gain the attention of the public at large to the importance of biological diversity.
When you decided to become a scientist, did you ever see yourself writing the kind of prose that you write in books like The Diversity of Life?
No. I didn't really get into what you would call serious writing until I published sociobiology. I was in my middle 40s then, and the world of social evolution, social organization, from ant colonies and coral reefs through wolf and chimp societies up to human societies, were so enthralling and aesthetically beautiful when put together in patterns that I couldn't resist writing it in literary style, or lyrical style, shall we say, at least parts of it.
If The Diversity of Life was your foray into the field of ethics, is the new book Consilience taking you into another field, a broader field?
It's broader. And the reason why I've written this book, which deals with a unity of knowledge generally, is that the last 25 years, roughly, since the publication of Sociobiology, which was a very controversial book because I had argued for a genetic basis of human nature and for a continuity of human mental activity, that field in the last 25 years has now become far more informed and sturdy. And what has happened is that the boundary between the natural sciences, particularly the biological sciences, on one side, and the social sciences and humanities on the other side, that famous boundary between the two cultures, the scientific and literary, has begun to vanish. And our perception of it has changing radically. We now are beginning to see that as not a barrier, you know, not a Hadrian's wall that keeps the scientific reductionist barbarians out of high culture, as many on the other side see it, but a broad domain of mostly unexplored phenomena concerning mind and culture that are subject to cause and effect explanations and can unite in our study of them through the great branches of learning, the natural science, social sciences, humanity. So that's what Consilience, this new book, is all about. Consilience means literally a jumping together, a convergence of causal explanations in very different disciplines. It's the mother's milk of the natural sciences. So we're beginning to get a wholly different conception of how knowledge links together. And the crucial area is indeed the borderland area between the biological sciences on one side and the social sciences and humanities on the other.
It's a very optimistic book, isn't it? Are you optimistic about the future of the sciences?
Intensely. If it is correct, maybe you could call it the consilience or the general consilience hypothesis or the consilience program. That word, incidentally, I've taken out of philosophy of science. It's a rarely used word, and the reason that I'm trying to put it in the mainstream now is that because it's rarely used, it's kept its purity of meaning, unlike coherence or interconnectedness, you know, which have many meanings. But I believe that, in fact, the trajectory of knowledge, particularly in the borderland area, is such that a substantially greater degree of unity is in the immediate future, and it will have enormous implications. I believe, for future research, self-examination of the human species, planning of our future, evaluation of ethics, and so on. But in addition, just arguing the thing, just, you know, getting a discussion going and arguing about general consilience is the logical place for the liberal arts to be revitalized and flourish again.
My guest tonight is E.O. Wilson, author of Consilience, The Unity of Knowledge. You say in the book that every college student should be able to answer this question. What is the relationship between science and the humanities, and how is it important to human welfare? How do you answer that question?
I knew one of these days I was going to have that thrown in, and that'll be my next anxiety dream, I guess, about having an exam. But in essence, what I would say is that the right answer, in the briefest form, the short answer, would be that the relationship pivots on human nature, which we now can define more precisely and say that it is human nature is not the genes that prescribe human nature. Human nature is not the cultural universals which characterize the human species overall, you know, possessed by virtually all societies, like incest taboos and color vocabularies and so on. But human nature is the set of epigenetic rules, the ways that the mind develops, the algorithms of the brain that cause human beings to see certain things, to feel certain things in particular ways, and to choose options during cultural evolution such as to reduce the cultural universal. Now, if we had another hour, I could spell out, as I have in the book Consilience, what these epigenetic rules are as we understand them to at the present time. And it is there, in the conjunction of genetics and psychology and anthropology and evolutionary biology, the study of the human epigenetic rules, their genetic basis, their history, their meaning, and so on, that we can come to a much deeper interpretation of the human condition and discuss in a coherent way with common language the relationship between science and the humanities.
As consilience becomes more accepted, as you expect it to, are we going to see a closer relationship between even religion and science?
I believe so. Already, religion has become, except for fundamentalist religion, which pays no attention, you know, to science and very little to the natural world, the liberal theology has already come much closer to science. Catholicism, for example, has moved decisively in the direction of scientific explanations of the material world. And where the rubber meets the road, and with the outcome yet to be determined, is the naturalistic explanation of the origin of religious emotion, fervor, commonality, and so on as a human phenomenon. And whether or not our ethics and our religious beliefs are transcendental in origin, that is, come from a divine source or some other outside source like natural rights, or whether, in fact, they can be seen and demonstrated to be human productions that have arisen from our own human nature and our basic needs.
I'm curious what you think of the work of Joseph Campbell in his series called The Masks of God, if you're familiar with him. He described the similarities in religion and mythology from every corner of the world, implying that they arose out of something innate in humans, maybe even something biological or genetic. Was Joseph Campbell a pioneer of consilience?
I think he was an important contributor. I'm not a mythologist, and I know it's fashionable to say, well, he was a popularizer and he overgeneralized, et cetera, et cetera. But nonetheless, it seems to me that he was onto something extremely important in modernizing the concept of the archetype and to show that indeed there are archetypes that are widespread through the human species and play an enormous role in our aesthetics and our preferences for certain art forms and narrative scenarios and the like.
As religion and science come closer together or find more common ground, do you think it's possible for science to provide spiritual fulfillment?
That's the, and this, I'm afraid this expression which I once used to love has been ruined in Baghdad. That is the mother of all questions. it is extremely important. I like to leave that open. Of course, I'm a secularist, and I do believe that, in fact, we will eventually develop a new myth, so to speak, you know, defined very broadly, a story of humanity based, that's more factual, that, in fact, has these great mythic components that appeal to the deepest currents, feelings out of human nature, and that eventually we may, in fact, get a cosmology and a way of expressing it means of forming a communal spirit, something comparable to the mystical union. But that lies in the future. And to me, that is going to be the 21st century equivalent of the struggle for men's souls. It's going to be a great spiritual search. I'd like to see it unfolding not as a conflict, as has traditionally been the case between theologians and secular humanists and scientists, but rather a common search with a lot of give and take and respectful cooperative scholarship on both sides.
To tone down the mother of all questions and maybe make it into just the daughter of all questions, does nature provide spiritual fulfillment for you personally?
Yes, it does. I think once you you learn enough, everyone can experience profound aesthetic pleasure and the sense of awe from nature that are major components of every religion and every more internalized spiritual experience. But once you start learning the details, one can say God is in the details instead of the usual, the devil is in the detail. Once you learn the details and the almost miraculous complexity and great length of the evolutionary journey that led to the life on Earth as it is today, you have many of the elements for a day-to-day perception that can be as deeply satisfying as most religious experiences.
In conclusion, how does your book Consilience, how does the concept of consilience help further your work and the world's work in conservation?
By giving higher value to the natural world, by helping us understand what I think most scientists, most scholars, even in the social sciences, recognize that we are a particular species that arose in the biological world of nature that surrounds us still, that we have the characteristics of many of the characteristics of the fauna and flora from which we arose, physiologically, even psychologically, and that we are part of this. It's part of us, and we really must treat it with a great deal more respect and reverence, at least keep it alive and flourishing until we can come to understand it well enough to give it the proper kind of stewardship.
Thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you for the opportunity.